We're so happy to have Sling TV as the sponsor of the World Soccer Talk podcast. This podcast is presented by Sling TV. From the Premier League on USA Network and NBC and Ligue 1 on beIN Sports, plus Copa Libertadores, also on beIN Sports, you can watch all these leagues and tournaments live on Sling for a starting price of $45 a month compared to Fubo's $70 a month. Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast. My name is Christopher Harris. I'm joined by my co-host, Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, there's a lot to get to this week, but one of the first topics I want to bring up is an article that appeared this week in Awful Announcing, which is a website that covers pretty much all sports, but more so from basically kind of the all sports version of World Soccer Talk, which goes into just talking about basketball, American football, baseball, TV coverage, announcers, stuff like that, celebrities, etc. And they had a story this week about CBS Sports' coverage of the UEFA Champions League and Champions League Today, the show that they have. And we've talked about CBS Sports quite a bit back and forth over the years. We broke the story that CBS Sports had acquired the rights to the Champions League a few years ago. But Kartik, for those who might have missed the Awful Announcing story, what was it about it in more detail, and what are your thoughts about it as a general topic?
Well, it basically said that CBS Sports coverage of the Champions League, their studio programs in particular, are setting the standard for broadcast sports on United States television, and that they're doing things in that studio and in presenting the Champions League that are innovative and new and lighthearted and engage the audience in a way that even some of the most successful sports programs, and you can think of them, the NBA coverage on Turner, the coverage of college sports on ESPN, the coverage of the NFL on CBS and Fox, that it's doing things that even those programs, those benchmarks, if you will, in sports broadcasting in the United States aren't doing. And I think there's some truth to that, but I also think that for some of us who are really hardcore soccer fans, the laughy, jokey thing has gotten a little over the top, right? I mean, we've complained in the past, Chris, about the formulaic nature of how NBC presents the Premier League, and they've tweaked that a bit the last year and a half or so since they re-upped the rights. They've gotten a little more creative, but there is a certain comfort level for those of us looking for analysis and just kind of a straight presentation in that versus the CBS approach.
I think that the fact that we're talking about it, and also Awful Announcing is writing about it, and we're discussing it, is a good sign in a way. Like, for example, when I look at NBC Sports, and you mentioned them a minute ago, I think I agree with you, Kartik. I think their coverage has improved. And I think a lot of that, too, is Danny Higginbotham, his involvement. And also bringing in Stephen Warnock is a good example, too, where they've kind of fine-tuned the coverage. And I think Tim Howard has stepped up. Rebecca Lowe has stepped up. And both of those stepping up has forced the two Robbies to step up too. So it's hit and miss, but it is in some ways formulaic now. You mean they've got the gold standards. It delivers every week. I'm not tuning in early as much as I used to when they first had the coverage. Partly because there's so many other soccer games on, right? I might catch a Bundesliga match, or I might catch a championship match on a Saturday morning, or I might catch Serie A early on a Sunday morning. So I don't feel the need to go to NBC Sports early. But as soon as that game starts, I'm hooked. CBS's coverage of the Champions League. So I watch it, and I think partly it's because, you mean, I'm an analyst, and we're watching this stuff. We're critiquing it. We're, you mean, talking about how good it is or room for improvement. So if I was just a soccer fan, would I tune in early to watch the coverage? And I think it's a yes, because I look at Kate Abdo, fantastic, right? A million times better than what she was at Turner Sports, Bleacher Report, doing the Champions League there. But I think now, too, in terms of she's really found her place much better than what she was at Fox. And she was good at Fox, and she was decent at Turner, but at CBS Sports, I mean, I think she's in the A game. And then you look at Jamie Carragher, Micah Richards, Thierry Henry. I think the three of them have a really good chemistry together. And looking at this week's coverage of the UEFA Champions League, there were some segments where I'm like, okay, this is funny. This is really entertaining. This is good to watch. Others that are kind of, it's hit and miss. Others that are like, that doesn't really interest me at all. But I still continue to watch. So I think the fact that we're talking about it is a good sign, because it is so different. It does shake things up. It is so different than others. You look at ESPN's coverage of soccer, for the most part, I think that's formulaic, right? That's kind of, we're so used to seeing that same studio, the same kind of format. That really hasn't changed much. Maybe with the coverage of La Liga, there's a lot more Sid Lowe or kind of correspondence, or it's FA Cup and you have correspondence on the pitch there. That's a little bit different. But overall, I think CBS Sports, in terms of the UEFA Champions League coverage, is heading in the right direction, to me personally. What would you say, though, Kartik, about NWSL?
Their coverage of NWSL, I think, is dragging. That's the best way I can put it. It's very... I was pretty excited that first match where they brought Jackie Oatley, the first broadcast match of the season where they, Kansas City and Portland, where they brought Jackie Oatley over to call the match. It's really, I think, just petering out, where they're going through the motions. It feels very much like Fox at the end of the Bundesliga run, right? Where they kind of curtailed the studio, where they were just kind of flipping a switch. Paramount Plus, their technical glitches last week. Because of life happening, I wasn't able to really focus on the Challenge Cup this week, although I plan to go back and watch those matches. I'm hoping it didn't happen on Wednesday night with the Challenge Cup. And it seems like they're just flipping the switch and letting end WSL Productions do the rest. So it's a very different approach than Champions League. And it's kind of interesting, Chris, because NWSL continues to get good numbers, right? Anytime an NWSL match is on CBS over the air, the numbers are comparable, if not better, than MLS matches on broadcast on over-the-air television. So that's kind of curious. I think maybe there's stuff going on behind the scenes that isn't out there in the public domain between CBS and NWSL. That's speculation. We can talk about that in another show. But it is very different. And this is something that's, to your point about ESPN. ESPN kind of flips the switch on everything, and it looks the same. So, for example, Bayern and gosh, why am I blanking out? They played Friday. No, they didn't play Friday last week. No, they didn't play Mainz. Why am I blanking out? They drew and Hoffenheim. Oh, yeah. The Bayern Hoffenheim match this past week, you had the same studio, K Murray, Ali Moreno. It's quite good, but it's the same studio you might have for a La Liga match, right? It kind of the same graphic, same style, same type of conversation. CBS, every product is different. We're talking about the way CBS covers Champions League and NWSL, but Serie A, which is another product, they cover radically different than they cover those two products. And then CONCACAF is different as well. So maybe you see that all fused together now in the Golazzo channel presentation. But to CBS's credit, I think they've taken each product, they've tried to understand the market for each product, and they understand soccer is not this all-encompassing thing where everybody watches everything. There are these niches, there's a lot of tribalism around the sport in this country. And they have created a unique feel for each product. Whether it's a good feel or a bad feel, that's up to the viewer. But they have created a unique feel for each set of rights that they have.
Out of all of the different sports TV networks, specifically to soccer, CBS Sports is the one that's shaking things up a lot more, right? beIN Sports' studio looks the same now as it did maybe like 5 years ago. Same thing with ESPN, same thing with NBC. But they're doing things differently behind the scenes. So CBS is definitely changing things, mixing things up, trying new things. And I think the Golazzo Network as a concept, again, I think it's a great concept. Morning Footy, the show, again, it's still it's a challenge to really try to entertain, inform, and hold the audience when you talk about the tribalism, Kartik, where, I mean, there's a lot of fans, there are USMNT fans that do not watch MLS, but they watch the Premier League. So when you talk about MLS on a Golasso Network on Morning Footy, are you losing your audience? Are they tuning out? Are they like, ah, I'm done with this show? Vice versa, too. There's a lot of MLS fans that are like very sensitive to any criticism about the league. It's like, ah, those are MLS haters. Let's stay away from that show. I don't want if they talk about Wrexham, I'm out of here. So I think the Golasso Network and Morning Footy specifically, they've come a long way in a couple of weeks, and I think that they're trying things. And when I do watch the show, some of the segments, I'm like, ugh, this is pretty, I don't know, boring. Other segments, I'm like, oh wow, okay, that's good, that's really interesting. And I think a lot of it too. So I lean towards Nico Canto as kind of the expert on the show, and his opinions align with mine. And then when I hear Charlie Davis sometimes with his opinions, I'm like, oh my gosh, he doesn't get it. He's like so in the tank for whether it's MLS or USMNT. But however, I would say that he has grown in a couple of weeks. So he's talking about topics that I never knew that he had any knowledge or experience in. And I think part of that too is with CBS Sports, Charlie Davis was used for the most part for the last couple of years really on the CONCACAF Nations League coverage, on the USMNT coverage. And I thought that when they had that and showed those games, so they still have it, when they showed those games, Clint Dempsey was the one that kind of had the honest, critical analysis. And Charlie was the one that had very much in the tank about USMNT and MLS and kind of defending them, being kind of a little bit defensive or a little bit sensitive to any criticism of any players. I'll give them full credit to CBS Sports and the Golasso Network and Morning Footy for trying different things. There's a lot of things that can be improved with that show that they should be doing that they're not doing. But I'm interested to see where it goes from here.
One thing I should point out real quickly is that ESPN has added, which people who subscribe to the ESPN FC YouTube channel have probably seen, these YouTube quick reactions after matches, generally hosted by Kay Murray. Sometimes it's Mark Donaldson. Giannis Mihalik, who I love, who I think is one of the best in the business, is usually on as one of the analysts. And sometimes Luis Miguel Echeverri also, who's very good. So they have added that to their UT presence, which is something innovative, something new, something I think is really good, something I watch, but I'm not sure many people know about it, Chris. So they have changed a little bit, but maybe they haven't promoted that as well as they need to.
Well, that's the thing about the Golasso Network is I think it's a really smart concept because it is free, or if you subscribe to Paramount Plus, it's included in there too. So it's more accessible if you want to. You can go to cbssports.com and watch it for free on there. And it opens you up to a whole bunch of other coverage or whole bunch of other hosts that they have. And sometimes ESPN is so big and there's so many different things going on that I probably missed those YouTube clips and those kind of quick reactions. What I would say with ESPN and some of the ways that they are better in some categories than CBS Sports are those expert opinions. So whether it's Mark Ogden, or whether it's Gab Marcotti, whether it's Craig Burley, Steve Nichol, you go down the list, right? There's a lot of people with a lot of really, really good insights into the game, former players. And you look at, say, Morning Footy as an example, and kind of their analysis of a show, there's only one of those people on that crew that's a former player. The rest of them are pundits like ourselves. But yeah, I think it's exciting times really right now to be a soccer fan. So having all of the different options available to us in terms of different shows, different types of shows, different streaming services. You mean whether it's a Sling TV or a Fubo or you mean Paramount Plus, Peacock, etc. Even going to the HBO Max, right? HBO Max showing this week the U.S. men's national team game against Mexico. having that game available through streaming there, as well as on TBS, as well as on Telemundo, Universo, Peacock, etc. So there's so many options, and that's really kind of where we focus a lot of our time and energy, is trying to make it as simple as possible to let people know how to watch the games and to kind of steer them in a direction of watching some of these matches or telling them about where you can watch this coverage. Speaking of that, Kartik, one of the things I'm interested in, and for a lot of listeners probably listening to the show right now, this may be old news by the time they listen to the show, but I really think in terms of Wrexham AFC, it's probably one of the best times to be, I'm not a Wrexham supporter, but it's one of the best times to be following Wrexham, because I think that every single thing that they're doing, both on the pitch and off the pitch, is perfect, right? It's perfection. And we have this weekend, this game, Wrexham against Boreham Wood on Saturday. I think it's 1:30 Eastern time. And available through streaming through National League TV. So you have to pay to watch the game. But if they win this game, they're through. Automatic promotion, winning the title, and into League Two. If they do make it, Kartik, I mean, and at this point, hopefully they don't screw up and miss out and Notts County wins the title. If they do make it into League Two, what does that future look like for a Wrexham AFC supporter or someone interested in the club watching that league from the United States? What will that experience be like in League Two? Will it be better than what it is in the National League as it is now?
Well, I'm not pulling for either side. I have to preface it by that, because Notts County was one of the 12 original clubs in the Football League, and I want to see them back in the Football League. So good luck to Wrexham, but also good luck to Notts County. What it will be like for the side that's promoted, presumably Wrexham in this case, is you can buy an iFollow subscription to see every match streaming. Sometimes the streaming quality isn't so good. I'm going to warn about that. But you can buy an iFollow subscription, and occasionally, particularly during international breaks, if you're in the United States, matches from League Two are on ESPN Plus. Although my sense is, because it's Wrexham and obviously the ties between Wrexham and Disney, you might see more games broadcast on ESPN Plus, and you might see maybe some games on linear, perhaps, like we saw during the FA Cup run this year. Another thing to look for is the Football League has gotten better with clipping highlights and putting them on YouTube in the last 6 to 8 months. They used to be terrible at this. They would only clip the highlights of the games that were broadcast internationally, right? The one match per week for League Two, the one match per week from League One, the three or four from the Championship. So what they are doing now is they're taking highlights from the iFollow without graphics. I have to admit it, you know, you're going to have to watch the whole highlights package to even know what's going on in the match, because there's no score bug in the corner, etc. But they are clipping highlights, and you can find highlights now on YouTube of just about every Football League match, which wasn't the case even a year ago.
Yeah, we don't want to jump too far into the future, but I will. And that is, if Wrexham does get promoted to League Two, if they do decide to go ahead and make games available through iFollow, which is in partnership with the English Football League, with that streaming service, is that it will cost the average soccer fan in the United States probably anywhere between $150 and $250 a season to subscribe to that, to be able to watch every single home and away game, except for those games that do show up on ESPN Plus, which might be one or two games a month. Very few as of right now. But like you said, Kartik, too, maybe Disney puts the pressure on the English Football League and says, like, hey, you mean this is an opportunity to really kind of promote League Two. Notts County, I would argue, has gotten more publicity this season because of Wrexham, and hopefully Notts County. Yeah. I agree with you. Hopefully they'll go up too. Maybe it'll be through the playoffs. Hopefully I'd love to see them back in the Football League. So the other thing about this Wrexham thing, though, too, if they decide to not go with iFollow, if they wanted to, they could set up their own streaming service outside of iFollow and say, okay, we're going to go ahead and show all the games. We're going to basically handle all of the streaming ourselves, obviously probably outsourcing it to somebody, and charge a different price and include different coverage and features and footage. that's a possibility if they wanted to do that. However, if they were thinking about doing that, they would have had to start making plans well in advance to be ready to be able to actually handle that. So in some ways, with the National League TV, I mean, to watch this game against Wrexham against Boreham Wood on Saturday, if you subscribe on the day for National League TV, it's £9, I think it is, which is roughly about $11. And you get to watch, if you want to, you can watch all the games on the National League TV on Saturday, as opposed to iFollow, which usually, for me, for example, as a fan of Swansea City, if I want to do on a single game, it's basically $11 just for one game. But yeah, it'll be definitely fascinating to see what Wrexham does if and when they get promoted. Kartik, big news this week from US Soccer, and that is that they and the Mexican FMF have filed a joint bid to co-host the Women's World Cup in 2027. Now, if successful, if FIFA agrees with this and gives the 2027 Women's World Cup to the U.S. and Mexico, the decision is expected next year. But this would mean something historic. We would have the Men's World Cup in 2026 hosted in the U.S. as well as Mexico and Canada. 2027 would be U.S. and Mexico. And then 2028 is the Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. What for you, when you think about the possibility of having these three tournaments back to back to back, what are the possibilities? I mean, other than generating huge amounts of revenue for FIFA, could this change something in the United States in terms of soccer at all?
I mean, maybe. I think the bottom line is it's there to generate huge revenue for FIFA, as you said. I suppose that there will be a bit of a bounce from the World Cup, the Men's World Cup in 2026. We saw a bounce from the 1999 Women's World Cup, but we did not see one from the 2003 Women's World Cup, which was supposed to be in China, got moved because of the SARS pandemic, got moved to the United States at late notice. The timings were kind of odd. So we did not get the kind of bounce out of that tournament we expected. I think there was a slight bounce out of the 2016 Copa America that was hosted in the United States. But I think the bigger bounces, Chris, actually, I personally have a problem with all, I'll preface this by saying I personally have a problem with all these summer friendlies, because I think player health and welfare is now becoming an issue, and additional games, additional travel, I don't think it's good. But I think there's been a bigger bounce for general interest in the sport on the basis of summer friendlies hosted in the United States than summer international tournaments recently. Now, that could change again, because we're talking about a Men's World Cup and potentially a Women's World Cup in back-to-back years, and obviously a Copa America also in 2024. So that's three out of four summers with international tournaments. That might change it, but right now I would say actually these friendlies and European clubs touring, when South American clubs come, that's done more to kind of because I think the international game has already captured kind of the general sports fan, and they're only interested in that or in tournaments. The hardcore soccer fan has been captured and created or stimulated by summer friendlies.
Yeah, that's interesting you mentioned that, Kartik, because it's contrary to other people's opinions, right? A lot of people out there say, like, these summer friendlies, what a waste of time. Only the C team shows up. Nobody cares about them. And the reality is, you know, and I know, we've seen it firsthand in the International Champions Cup, which seems to have basically disappeared now because it's been replaced by the League's Cup, as well as other tournaments or other competitions. I think the leagues, the actual teams have gotten smarter. Some of them are going out on their own, knowing, probably learned a lot of lessons from the International Champions Cup and saying, hey, if we're Manchester United, we can go ahead and do a tour ourselves. We'll play, our academy team will play Wrexham. Our first team will play Borussia Dortmund in Las Vegas. And we're going to announce a couple other major friendlies and actually probably generate more money that way, perhaps, or at least be more in control. And I think, but we've seen those sold out stadiums. I was at the Real Madrid against Manchester United game at the University of Michigan all those years ago when it set a record soccer attendance ever in this country. And having said all of that, and you and I know that, Kartik, but there's still a lot of people out there that really dismiss some friendlies and say, like, ah, you mean this is, it's basically kind of bandwagoners or just people jumping on this thing. And you saw it last summer too, right? The Chelsea against Arsenal game in Orlando, and just the passion and all of these Arsenal fans that have come from across the country to come to a game, to watch a game, to see them in person and see at that time how they completely were so much better than Chelsea. And you and I were talking about, I think, in July or August, as soon as the season started, our concerns about Chelsea. And there were a lot of people on Twitter that came after us saying, like, ah, you guys are just Chelsea haters. And we're like, no, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing faults in this Chelsea side, so on and so forth. So it is interesting, right? Because I think I agree with you. I think, yeah, definitely these club friendlies, yes, they generate a lot of money for the clubs, but also they do build a lot of fans. And I've seen that personally from my experience too, where it has created fans. It has made soccer fans like that club because they came over and they continue to come over and they feel a connection. And with the international teams, yeah, definitely U.S. men's national team, etc., that builds fan bases too. But how often do we get to see the U.S. men's national team, right? We saw them in January play a couple of friendlies against Colombia and Serbia. We saw them this week play a friendly against Mexico.
Well, I mean, you have to rob a bank to go see the U.S. men's national team play in person. I mean, that's the reality of the ticket prices. I mean, the U.S. Soccer Federation charges more for meaningless friendlies for the U.S. men than France charges they were the world champions, right? They got to the finals this year, to the World Cup final. But you know, one of the great, the elite footballing nation charges for qualifiers, UEFA Euro qualifiers or World Cup qualifiers. So let's put that in context, right? I mean, part of it is that supporting the U.S. men's national team has become a very elite thing. And there's no kind of participatory culture in it like there is for these Arsenal fans. You know, a lot of these Arsenal fans I talked about in Orlando, they didn't actually go to the match, right? They didn't actually go to the Citrus Bowl that night. They were there to partake in the club culture, the rituals, the customs, and it didn't matter what players played for them, right? Again, this is the other thing when people say, oh, well, they send C teams. Okay, they send C teams, but they're still wearing the Arsenal kits. They're still doing the Arsenal things. And again, I personally don't like these friendlies because I think we're at a point where there are too many games, there's too much travel. I wish we would just call a timeout during the summer. But the reality is I'm trying to just be objective here. They're doing more from my perspective, from observing this objectively, to build support for football, support for soccer in the United States than these international matches and the U.S. men's national team are. I mean, in fact, I don't know that the U.S. men's national team has done anything to really grow the game in the United States other than create a generation of kind of jaded, toxic social media presence fans. I don't think actually if you go throughout the country that and you talk to soccer fans that they're focusing on the next USMNT friendly or they're only watching Borussia Mönchengladbach highlights because Joe Scaly plays for them, right? I think that's a niche thing that's overrepresented on social media.
Niche thing that's also overrepresented on CBS Sports Glasser Network too, because a lot of the coverage, well, not a lot, some of the coverage is kind of centers on that. And that's something that I think we've written about or talked about before, where I think it's social media sometimes driving content, and I don't like that. I mean, because I think it's one of those things that it's misguided. It's that's part of the footy morning footy show I don't like, is where it goes down that rabbit hole where it's like, come on, guys. You mean, yes, there are USMNT fans that only watch Borussia Dortmund or only watch Frankfurt because of one player on the pitch. but that is not the majority. That
they're not even watching the Frankfurt or Borussia Dortmund games, honestly, right. Chris. They're watching highlights, and then they're exaggerating the quality of that American player because the highlights have been selectively cut. I mean, it's unbelievable, and I don't know how these people can make judgments about club football and players when the only thing they're concerned about is a U.S. friendly 3 months down the road.
So what I would say that, so kind of circling back to what we talked about a minute ago, is for the possibility, right, of the Women's World Cup coming in 2027 to here, plus we've got the 2026 World Cup and we've got the 2028 Summer Olympics, there is an opportunity here to really grow the game, because you mentioned that the US MNT are really not growing the game, but from the amount of revenue that's going to be generated from these competitions, most of it going to FIFA, a lot of it going to the US economy, but there will be a lot of revenue coming in for US soccer. They need to make seismic changes to improve this game in the United States. They really need to kind of think about, okay, what is this going to do for us, other than to basically kind of pay the legal bills on a lot of these lawsuits, but to thinking for the future. Because for the 1994 World Cup, the money that came in, the millions that came in from that, that started Major League Soccer. You mentioned the 2003 Women's World Cup. That was, you mean, almost 24 years ago by the time 2027 rolls around. So there's opportunities to go ahead and take that money and do something
and
positive
by the,
with it.
By the way, to your point, right to your point, the 2016 Copa America, we saw how much money, because U.S. Soccer's records were public, we saw how much money that put in the U.S. Soccer Federation's coffers, and most of that money ended up being redirected and repurposed to handling lawsuits. So it gave the U.S. Soccer a huge surplus, an incredible amount of money. I wish I had the financial report in front of me. I could tell you how much. But it was a lot of money. And then we saw legal fees because of all these antitrust lawsuits and equal pay lawsuits and such that the U.S. soccer had to then was a defendant in. And that money could have been put to grassroots soccer. It could have been put toward promoting the U.S. Open Cup, making the U.S. Open Cup a more viable competition, which I think should be the first responsibility of this federation. Instead, it went to being defendants in lawsuits because shareholders, again, I want to stress this, stakeholders in the game, leagues, whether it's NASL, players, whether it's when it's the U.S. women, other entities involved in the sport, like Relevant Sports, clubs, when it was Miami FC and Stockade FC. Obviously, I prefaced this by saying I worked for Miami FC at the time, had to enter litigation against the federation because of the way they were doing business. So, this surplus, the money they make from these competitions could go be repurposed in the wrong directions if they don't shape up.
Yep. Or vice versa. It could go in the right direction if they do shape up and realize what changes they need to make to really help grow this game in the future, because there's a lot that needs to be fixed. So, hopefully we'll talk about more of this in future episodes. One quick thing in the TV streaming news, Kartik, before we go on to the listener mailbag, and that is some great news from CBS Sports Golazo Network. I'll let you tell the listeners about that.
Yeah, so CBS Sports is going to be showing on the Golazo channel the Women's Champions League semifinals, which and the final, but the semifinals more immediately, which is really exciting because we've been forced to watch it on DAZN's YouTube channel to this point. So Chelsea-Barcelona, which by the time folks listen to this, the first leg might have taken place. That's Saturday, the 22nd at 7:30 a.m. Eastern. Wolfsburg-Arsenal first leg is Sunday, the 22nd at 9:30 a.m. Eastern time. And then the second legs are April 27th in the Chelsea-Barcelona tie, and in the Wolfsburg Arsenal tie, it's May 1st. Those kickoff times are both 12:45 p.m. Eastern, and CBS bringing it live on the Golazo channel. Women's Champions League is kind of where it's at now. in women's club football. So I know a lot of people in the United States continue to say NWSL is the best league in the world. It's the highest standard. Maybe we'll get a more definitive reading on that this summer, the Women's World Cup. But Women's Champions League is fantastic. I recommend everybody check it out.
All right, let's move on to listener mailbag. First up to talk about MLS Season Pass is NPOB1. He says, or he or she says, MLS Season Pass is also competing against XFL and USFL football. On top of that, none of the ESPN websites are mentioning MLS. Dave says, enjoyable discussion, lots of interesting listener comments on MLS and Apple. A few reactions to last week's episode. Number one, many issues with men's soccer in the U.S. are due to USSF, U.S. Soccer Federation failures. There is a tried and true global model for player development, domestic leagues, and national teams. Of course, adaptations are needed based on dynamics in a given country, but it is different in the U.S., is too often an excuse to discount everything that works elsewhere. The U.S. soccer model is very favorable to a subset of wealthy, powerful, entrenched interests, so we are probably stuck with it. Number two, I read in several places the theory that Apple may have signed MLS mainly to get the affluent core MLS fan base more entrenched in the high-margin Apple ecosystem. I sort of discounted that as too cynical, but it is fascinating Kartik heard the same from an industry insider. If I was a MLS owner, I would be irate if that rumor was true. Number three, several commenters noted long and largely meaningless regular seasons followed by bloated playoffs are a staple of U.S. Mainstream sports. Fun to hear Kartik's reaction to learning 20 of the 30 NBA teams make the postseason, even as only 16 of 30 NBA teams make the full playoffs. Next up is Nick. Nick says, I'm grateful that you're back on the podcast, but saddened to hear the reasons for the break. I wish Kartik and his family all the best and hope your dad is able to get well soon. I have to agree with a lot of the listener feedback from last week on MLS. I've been thinking about why I myself watch very little MLS. And for me, it boils down to the fact that in my opinion, MLS offers very little that I can't find elsewhere, either with better quality or for cheaper. If I'm a soccer fan, I'm going to prioritize the quality and higher stakes of any given European league or cup match. If I'm a soccer-curious US sports fan, I will likely still lean towards European games, as MLS clashes with larger US sports leagues, except for a few summer months, and the subscriptions for European competitions are far cheaper. If I'm a USMNT fan, most of the top players I'm most interested in play in Europe anyway. The only two things that MLS offers that I can't find elsewhere are, number one, the ability to see games in person, and number two, the ability to see live games on TV in prime time. For me, the first point is irrelevant as I live in the New York metro area. The New York Red Bulls play an hour and a half away, which is too inconvenient. And I'm frankly not interested in watching games on a shrunken field at a baseball stadium on any regular basis. Going to games in person only applies to maybe 100,000 people in each market anyway. The second point for me is also not a strong enough reason to watch MLS, as I will either get my soccer fix watching live matches from Europe in the morning or early afternoon, and then do something else in the evening. Or if I'm not able to watch live matches, I will watch recorded matches and or highlights in the evening in place of MLS. Bottom line is, for me personally, MLS does not offer anything compelling enough for me to watch on a regular basis that I can't find a better, cheaper version of elsewhere. This is just my personal experience, but I don't think I'm alone in feeling this way. And taking most games off of regular TV coupled with the price tag of the MLS Apple deal won't help get people in my boat interested. I buy the points you guys have been making about production quality, and perhaps if they offered a discounted subscription for just the Whip Around show, similar to NFL Red Zone, I'd be interested, but without that, it's a non-starter for me. Kartik, your thoughts?
Yeah, first off, thank you for the well wishes, Nick. I agree. Yeah, I think that we're in the position where unless you have some sort of vested interest in the club as a supporter, MLS just isn't very appealing, particularly in larger markets. And this is something that I've observed for years. The best, the markets where MLS does the best, Atlanta being an exception, right? Because Atlanta is a huge television market and they've done great there, credit to them. But outside of that, the markets that MLS does best are Portland, Salt Lake City, Kansas City. Although Kansas City is a competitive sports market, it's also a small market. Now St. Louis, which is, again, competitive sports market, but a small market. Nashville, not that huge a market. Orlando at one time. The bigger markets, MLS really struggles in. The top TV markets, top largest urban areas in the country, Philadelphia, they've done okay, but they're still down the pecking order there. New York, they're not doing particularly well. Boston, they're not doing well. Los Angeles, I don't care how good LAFC is, there's still a blip there. The San Francisco Bay Area, they've never registered. Miami, Houston, again, Dallas, huge. Metro areas, huge urban areas, they don't do very well in. So I think that, Nick, you're onto something. And maybe it's places where it's more convenient to get to the stadium. Maybe there's more of a local pride factor involved that they do well. And they do well in those places. Nashville's been great, right? Charlotte's going pretty well so far. But like I said, I think that with the except... Oh, Chicago is the most notable one, right? Huge market where they just are nothing in. With the exception of Atlanta, basically, it's the smaller markets where MLS does really well. And I think that that's pretty telling.
Yeah, there's a few things about this, Kartik. I think, first of all, I think for MLS fans, it's time to stand up and be counted. So if you do support MLS and you're a fan of an MLS team, subscribe to MLS Season Pass, because that's really pretty much the only way to watch the vast majority of games, or actually all of the games. You can watch a game now and again, maybe one a weekend on Fox. But so at the end of the day, those MLS Season Pass subscriber numbers will be very telling. We may never see those numbers, what those numbers are, which is convenient, because if they were massive numbers, Netflix does report numbers at times. So does ESPN Plus at times. So does Peacock at times. When those numbers are good enough, and I get calls from public relations people from those companies saying, like, hey, Chris, just FYI, Peacock last week, which actually the Liverpool-Arsenal game, Kartik, just to give you an idea, the Liverpool against Arsenal game, which was exclusively on Peacock, a couple of weeks ago now, had 840,000 people that watched that game on Peacock. Peacock alone. So it is possible to have massive numbers watching soccer on a streaming service. So if those numbers are good enough with MLS and Apple, they will report those numbers. If they don't, it's an uncomfortable truth there. I think the other thing about MLS in terms of this season too is that, what's there to look forward to? So I've mentioned on previous episodes, maybe a big signing, right? Maybe a Messi or someone of that level. But then you're riding the coattails of that player to watch the league. The same thing for League's Cup. League's Cup, MLS is riding the coattails of Liga MX fans. They know how many Liga MX fans are out there, how passionate they are about their team, about their country, about those players. They are hardcore of the hardcore. And with that comes massive numbers to watch those games. So MLS, in many ways, smartly doing good business, did the deal with Liga MX because they know what that fan base can bring in revenue and subscriptions to MLS Season Pass. But again, it's MLS riding the coattails of Liga MX. Outside of that, yes, I would say let's look forward to the playoffs and the MLS Cup final, see how it goes. But it's a bad time of the year in terms of the calendar. So we've talked about these things many, many times in the past. Nothing changes. However, I really think that MLS needs to attack these issues and actually kind of confront them and be honest with themselves. Next up, talking about the Champions League, and we talked before about CBS's coverage of the Champions League. Corey says, thanks to Chris for getting on CBS for the studio hijinks during the Champions League pregame coverage, which has become unbearable. As a fan invested in the big knockout matches the past 2 weeks, having to sit through their forced chuckles and staged irrelevant topics while squeezing in short bursts of simple analysis between commercials was a very frustrating experience. Maybe this works for casual fans or would be better as a post-game experience. NBA on TNT or ESPN FC Extra Time. In its current form, the emotions of a European night at electric sold-out stadiums are getting trampled by forced segments. Would not recommend. So I wouldn't go that far as far as not recommending it. But for me personally, the way I experience the Champions League is I'm actually watching different things at the same time. So I'll be watching the pregame coverage on Paramount Plus from, Kate and Jamie and Thierry, etc., Mika. But then maybe during a commercial break, I'm listening to the BBC or Sky Sports or SiriusXM or TalkSport and trying to take in all of the different bits and pieces or on social media too, looking at different clips as far as what's happening in the stadiums. And oftentimes I'm finding myself learning more or finding out more information from those other sources than CBS, because CBS has focused so much time on kind of the entertainment feature, right? It's all about them. It's not so much about the games. The games are kind of secondary. Just the way it's been treated, a lot of it is about the personalities. And those personalities are great, right? I mean, I'd say all of those, Kate, Micah, Thierry, and Jamie are all people that we respect in different ways as professionals. They have fun, definitely. But it is, again, going back to the very beginning of this show, it's very hit and miss. I mean, some of it is good, some of it's bad, some of it is entertaining, some of it's I'll turn off and watch something else instead. But it gets us talking about it. All right, lower league soccer, Kartik. We got a lot of feedback from listeners discussing last week's podcast about lower league soccer. Danny Hatsune says, U.S. lower division soccer is all dead unless you buy your way into MLS. Without pro rel, watching soccer in the U.S. is useless. Teams fold left and right, and USL has no exposure thanks to being behind a paywall. I'd rather support real teams that play in real leagues. So I want to get your feedback on that, Kartik, too, as well as I know you got some heat for last week's comments about USL in particular in terms of the quality level. Just want to give you an opportunity to kind of talk about that if you want to, as well as to address Danny's comments about watching. He'd rather watch real teams play in real leagues.
Yeah, I get that, Danny, and I agree in the sense that the U.S. system is filled with closed leagues that really don't follow FIFA rules, right? It's not just MLS that doesn't, honestly. I would include every league in the United States has some sort of closed, franchise-based, league-driven mechanism that prevents it from being as organic as it should be. That having been said, these clubs are very important to local markets. You see what Chattanooga FC, which started as an adult amateur club in NPSL around 2009, what they've done, and they're now a professional club, but what they've done for their local community and the kind of support they've been able to sustain in that market and grow the sport and grow interest in the sport in Tennessee. Same sort of thing with Detroit City. There are countless examples of this. I know we're going to get into one of the examples in a minute with someone writing in the mailbag. But in general, I want to make a comment about some of the backlash I got for what I said on this podcast earlier in the week, which really surprised me. But actually, it shouldn't have surprised me. I know the subset we're dealing with. For me, constructive critiques are important. We want the product to succeed. I want USL. I really want USL to succeed. I'm a lower division guy, as I think many of you know, and in terms of my orientation to the sport in this country. And the reality is, for those of us on this podcast, Chris and I, and so many of our listeners and other people involved with World Soccer Talk, we care enough about lower division soccer to actually make the critical suggestions that should make people think more about how they can grow these leagues and their local clubs. If you don't like those suggestions, I think maybe you're living in a bubble and think that USL or NISA or whatever league we're talking about, NPSL, is much bigger than it is. It has a much bigger fan base than it does. In the bigger scheme of things, these products have to market themselves better. USL has to market itself better. NISA has to market itself better. NPSL, I've seen backslide the last couple seasons, quite frankly. And I think you talk to anyone objectively within the industry, they agree with that. UPSL, same thing. I'll say I've seen serious improvement in NISA this year, both on the pitch and in terms of their marketing, but they're still a long way away and have to continue to improve, and we're going to continue to make those critiques so they do improve. If you're a lower division fan or involved in lower division soccer in this country, you need to stay humble and hungry. If not, you're going to have the same arrogance and entitlement. You're going to reflect the same arrogance and entitlement that so often lower division fans claim MLS fans and the media and people involved in MLS have. Yeah, you're showing some of the same characteristics if you don't take these constructive critiques and try and build on them.
I'm very curious, Kartik, what the plans are for USL, NISA, NPSL, you mean MLS Next Pro, et cetera, all of the lower league divisions in the United States, based on 2026, 2027, and to some regards, 2028, how are they going to take advantage of these opportunities that are coming to them? What is U.S. Soccer going to do to make sure or to try to help organize this together, create a system, or whatever it may be, right? There's opportunities here for the leagues and for the U.S. Soccer Federation to really correct things. I mean, make things better, improve things, make it so that there is more interest from the lower leagues all the way up to the top leagues. I mean, in some markets in the United States, as it is right now, there may not be a local team. Or if there is a local team, what is their pathway to grow as a club through the different divisions? Is there a pathway at all? Why should someone be invested, not money-wise, but with their time and energy in a local club? So there needs to be meaning there. There needs to be a reason to exist, a reason to work hard, to focus and improve on the pitch, and how that helps the whole system in general in the United States.
Yeah, and you know, it's been 58 months since the U.S. was awarded hosting rights for the 2026 World Cup. And I had hoped by now, and I granted COVID was in the middle of that, so maybe that's an asterisk. But I had hoped by now we would have much more comprehensive and constructive plans from either the stakeholders, the leagues themselves, or the federation, preferably the federation, as to here's our blueprint for how we're going to take the increased exposure and enthusiasm around the 2026 FIFA World Cup and translate it to improving the pyramid and improving the pathway to pro and both the youth and professional game and college game, quite frankly, in the United States. Nothing. Haven't seen anything. 58 months. It seems like they just want to collect the money, go to the bank with it, and then hopefully spend it on good things, but maybe it'll be spent defending themselves from lawsuits again.
You mentioned Greg's comment. So let's read out Greg's comment. He says, very good discussion last week. Good points are all around about what makes lower leagues successful. I used to live in San Francisco, and there are decent, inexpensive lower league options. San Francisco City FC, which plays in USL League 2, is a majority owned by supporters through a inexpensive annual fee, which gets you a ticket to every home match, a scarf, which you get to vote on the design for, and a free beverage and food at one match. At least they did last year when I had a membership. They play in the 49ers first stadium in the middle of the city. Easy to get to by bike or transit. Individual match tickets aren't that expensive, and there's local beer and food vendors. The quality of play isn't the highest, but it's easy, fun, and cheap to go to a match. And they really connect with supporter members. Across the bay is Oakland Roots, who do a good job with Vibe. Those matches are fun, I'm told. Though sadly, I didn't get to go to one when I was living there. There's another team starting up in Oakland as well. And there's tons of good quality amateur leagues filled with Central South American immigrants, ex-college players, etc. Here in Denmark, where I now live, the main team I go to plays in the second division. The first match I was able to get to, I got in for free from a coupon on the front cover of the local free weekly newspaper. I went to another match expecting to pay, but for some reason that was free also. There's plenty of food and beverage, the play is pretty good, and you can see the guys who are on the way up. I'd much rather go to these matches than FC Copenhagen, though the FC Copenhagen experience is a good top-flight play and atmosphere. But for a Sunday afternoon out, give me a sunny day with fun vibe, cheap tickets, and a beer.
And I should mention, in reference to that, Oakland Roots are one of the model teams. So I mentioned Chattanooga and Detroit. Oakland is on their way to being that. And they're one of the anchor teams, I would say, now of lower division soccer. Also, if you're in SF, San Francisco City is wonderful. I agree with that. The SF Glens, San Francisco Glens, also a team that's in USL League 2. They have a women's team in the USLW League. They're another side to keep an eye on.
All right, last comment for the day, and this is from Mercator. He says, another good discussion on the lower leagues. The real issue is and always will be money. The US is not like Europe in this regards. Not only is enthusiasm for the sport not quite at the same level, everything in America is absurdly expensive. I was just reading somewhere, some British person laughing on Twitter at how New York City FC will spend $800 million for a 25,000-seat stadium. I have family involved in a now third division club in Europe. Everyone is a volunteer or under 15,000 euros a year. You can do that when people have health care from the state. The stadium where they play has been there for 100 years, and the club doesn't want to get promoted to the top division because it would require stadium improvements that no one has the money for. They take cheap train tickets to away matches. No real academy, just a smattering of unsubsidized youth teams made up of local kids. And if they are lucky, a talented immigrant who can make it to a big club. It's not really a business because it will never, ever make money. In the US, it's completely different. You need to negotiate with a university or something to even find a stadium to play in. Staff or part-time or volunteers meeting an average of 40 to 50 to 60 thousand salary plus healthcare is not realistic for most. There will be no academy in away matches, there will be no academy in away matches involved. Flights for $800. There is just an order of magnitude difference in cost right off the bat. America is not Europe. With its hundreds of years of tradition and low-cost structure, in the US you need money and tons of it to get anywhere. That is why I think the top-down MLS model is the right approach, to be blunt with you. You need billions in investment to even get something like MLS to where it is right now. It's not clear where this investment would come from in a pyramid system. Even successful European leagues face severe funding and investment issues, and when funding does come, it comes to 5 to 6 teams, not really the full pyramid. MLS has a clear path and the funding to back it up for 30, probably 40 teams right now. You can see long run how that could get to 60, 70, or 80 teams, all with real stadiums, subsidized academies, and top-tier infrastructure. That sounds like a far, far better future when compared to a pyramid system where NYCFC, LA, and some oligarch in Miami blow out the league on salaries and infrastructure, while the other 75 clubs languish in university stadiums in front of 2,000 crows with zero real hope for investment or growth. That's the reality of most lower league teams everywhere on earth, and that's in countries that are more enthusiastic about the sport generally than Americans. Wow. Mercator, dropping some major hits there, Kartik. Do you agree, for the most part, with what he's saying?
I agree with a lot of it. He's right about the business situation, and I've tried to make this point clear to people who follow lower division soccer that sometimes the costs involved are much higher than you think they are. So to maintain any sort of staff, you have to spend a lot of money, and he's right, right? In Europe, where the countries all have socialized medicine or free healthcare, I don't like the term socialized medicine, actually, but have universal access to healthcare, it's very different. You can pay less in salaries. They also have mass transit, so people can get to work more easily. So they don't need all this money part of the reason I needed the salary I got when I worked at the NASL and worked at various clubs was because of the need to fill my car with gas and make long drives to places. And he's absolutely right on the airfares. Travel costs kill lower division clubs. I do think that the cost of everything in the United States is absurd, and that drives it. At the same time, we have a situation where the U.S. Soccer Federation has generated a lot of revenue, as we've already talked about. And instead of investing that revenue in mitigating some of those costs for lower division teams and building a real pyramid, and also allowing the U.S. Open Cup to go from being a competition where the further you advance in the tournament, the more money you lose, because you have to rent those stadiums, everything Mercator mentioned, renting stadiums from the university. You also then have to pay for security. You have to market a game on short notice, which is usually midweek. Offsetting some of those costs and growing the sport in such a way with the money they've generated to where some of these costs can be mitigated. Instead, the money has been spent promoting the national teams and fighting off lawsuits. So promoting the national teams, which probably need less promotion than the actual grassroots clubs that exist 365 days a year in local markets. So, in fairness, U.S. Soccer spent a lot of money subsidizing the women's game through NWSL when it wasn't that economically viable. Now the league is, and U.S. Soccer has stepped away. But they have not done that on the men's side, is the point. And I think there are a lot of good points in what Mercator says. And yes, under the current structure, because of U.S. Soccer's being an absentee landlord, being completely AWOL, yeah, maybe the MLS structure is the only thing that can work, given the economics of the United States and the cultural differences between it and Europe. However, it didn't have to be that way, and it still doesn't have to be that way to kind of wrap a bow on this whole conversation we've had today, Chris. It doesn't have to be that way after the 2026 World Cup when at least we believe there'll be all this new revenue that comes in and their coffers will be flush with all kinds of money that they don't have now.
Yeah, this is why I find the whole MLS season pass Apple TV deal so fascinating, because Mercator says, I think the top-down MLS model is the right approach. And he talks about seeing the league increase to 30, which we know will happen, up to 40, and maybe in the future 60, 70, or 80. The part of it that I find fascinating is because MLS has lost all of that TV revenue except for the deal that they have with Fox, which is probably very minimal, if anything, in terms of what Fox is paying MLS. So a lot of the future growth of this league is dependent on expansion and also the success of MLS Season Pass. And MLS Season Pass is, from Apple, you're getting $250 million a year. But for year one, how much of that money that MLS spent on production facilities, on talent, as many as 100 people, and that's just in front of the camera. There's all the people behind the camera. All the expenses, all of the investment that they've put into making this a success. At the end of the day, after the season's over, how much money did they make out of that $250 million if they had to spend over $100 million on just getting it off the ground? It might even be much more than that. So the expansion part of it is fascinating because, yeah, so if a team comes in and they drop $250 million a year $250 million or more to get an expansion team. That will happen with cities such as Las Vegas, etc. But, what are the, when you look at the United States, Kartik, where's the biggest opportunities, right? San Diego is talking about having a team, so is Las Vegas. But outside of those two markets, and you look at the US, where are the markets that are the biggest possibilities or opportunities for MLS to get a new expansion city or investment group to pay that money? Like, where would you say would be next, those big cities?
I think the biggest metropolitan areas that don't have MLS teams, I believe, are Detroit, which has three professional teams, actually, two NISA teams and a USL team, the USL team being the really well-known one, right, Detroit City FC. And then Tampa Bay market, I think, is a really big market, which was one of the top markets in the old NASL, did well in the new NASL, and obviously now USL with the Rowdies. San Antonio, maybe too close to Austin. And then you look at Sacramento, right? That's a huge metropolitan area, actually an even bigger TV market than San Diego, where they announced that the Republic were moving up and now have backed off. And it's a kind of sordid situation. Indianapolis is another one potentially. But getting to 40 teams might require MLS, 40, 50 teams, to actually do what I think does build interest in the sport locally, which is to have second teams and markets. So whenever we have derbies, and this was the concept at the NASL between us having a team in Miami and Fort Lauderdale, right? The Fort Lauderdale team was kind of one of the anchor teams of the league, but we also have eventually put a team in Miami because the idea was to have a derby, and that builds local interest. And it's I think MLS is seeing the success of El Tráfico. You want to build context and interest with local derbies. Now, if you're trying to fill out your television profile in terms of media markets, you want to go to as many big media markets as possible. So that then kind of cancels out the idea of doubling up in markets, right? So now that they're off of linear television, well, they have this Fox deal, right? But they're basically off of linear television. They're doing exclusively Apple TV and streaming. Maybe it lends itself to saying, hey, maybe the Chicago Fire are a dud, but if we put another team in Chicago, the Chicagoland area, we can develop some context. Hey, FC Dallas isn't doing well in Frisco. Maybe if we put a team in the Cotton Bowl, in Dallas itself, or we put a team in Fort Worth or somewhere else in the area, Arlington, somewhere, we can build that context. I think that might be the way out of this for MLS. Otherwise, I think just adding more dots to the map, it hasn't done anything to move the national profile of the league. And I always thought the strategy for that, other than getting the expansion fees, which is short term, right, putting more money in short term and kind of just kicking the can down the road, was to increase your ability to get a good media deal because you've filled in all the dots that that media companies in the United States or linear television companies in the United States would be interested in. Now that they're on Apple, that doesn't matter anymore. So I think maybe they go in a different direction.
I would push back on the expansion, though, Conte, because there have been successes, right? So you look at St. Louis City FC or SC, whatever it is. But you look at also Austin, you look at Orlando, you look at Nashville. And that was something we've been crying out for a long time, right? As far as going back 10 years ago, that there were so few teams in the southeastern United States. And we got Nashville and Atlanta as kind of two case studies of really kind of filling that void and meeting the need there in those markets. But as far as like expansion, though, too, so Detroit, I still feel, is always going to be a Detroit City FC USL team or whatever league they're in, even in the future. Hopefully it'll be USL. It'd be difficult to really be a success in that market, given how popular and how many roots they have in the city.
Yeah, and that club, and that to the point to the listeners who may not understand this, that club will never be an MLS club because of because of all the issues we discussed with MLS, right? There, Detroit City is a very organic, supporter-driven entity, very political also. So they would just never fit into MLS, into the kind of box, static culture of MLS.
Yeah. And then Indy, maybe Indianapolis would get something. I don't know, just that, but that's a possibility. Sacramento, I mean, maybe MLS burnt that market and the Sacramento ties, maybe the fans wouldn't want to be back in or have the opportunity to be back in MLS, and maybe they're happy where they're at. San Antonio, like you said, too, maybe a little bit too close to other markets. But outside of those, I just don't see, I mean, like Mercator was mentioning, like 40 teams. Like, what are those markets? Because I don't think there would be the investors at this point willing to fork over the money to go into a market that is unproven or is that you mean is not going to be a success. So that's my concern there too. So long-term concern with MLS expansion is that that money is going to dry up at some point, where there's not going to be as many cities or investors willing to invest. And then at the same time too, with MLS season pass, I mean, we know that there's an opt-out clause.
I am telling you, Chicago in particular is a place where there is a desire for another team other than the Fire, who have done everything wrong, starting really since Andrew Hopman bought the team. He obviously sold the team, but Peter Wilt ran the team really well. Peter's the maestro of this stuff. But that's why USL was talking to the Cubs about putting a team in kind of the Wrigleyville area of Chicago. That's why NISA went into that market for a year. That's why, quite frankly, when I was at NASL, I was playing on Google Earth. Derek Reese, who also works for World Soccer Talk, and can attest to this, he and I would do it together, looking for places in the Chicagoland area where we could stick a team because the Fire were so weak. I still think that that's a place where if you're MLS, you stick another team. Okay, you don't just rebrand the Fire, which I think they're going to do, and say, oh, well, we move back into the city, so it'll work now. You put another team out in Naperville or in the northern suburbs, maybe you put another team in Bridgeview, for all I know. That stadium's still there, and the Red Stars still play there. That's what I would do if I were them, honestly.
Yeah, for me personally, I would say no to that, only because, like, so for example, if we take the case of Inter Miami and Miami FC, who both still exist right now, but both of them are poor teams going on a poor run of form, not being success stories. I mean, yes, they're in different leagues, they will face each other next week in the US Open Cup, but you mean there isn't a lot of yes, there are two teams in a relatively regional same market, but we're not seeing that kind of increased interest because of that. But Chicago, I mean, Chicago now is playing at Soldier Field. They're playing in front of a stadium that's pretty empty for the most part. The team is pretty good. You got Ezra Hendrickson as a coach. They're not a bad team. They've made mistakes. They're improving things. But just adding a team to that market, I don't think it's going. You need a strong team, first of all. You need a strong MLS team. And then maybe bring in another team then to add some competition, such as you had in the past with LA Galaxy, perhaps back in the day when they were, you know, one of the best teams in MLS. And then you add LAFC to that equation, and now all of a sudden LAFC makes LA Galaxy look bad in terms of the success on the pitch. But yeah, good thoughts there, Kartik. Definitely. And listeners, again, thank you so much for all of the listener mailbag feedback there. If you do want to have your say, there's a bunch of different ways you can get in touch with us. So if you want to, you can leave a voicemail. That is 561-247-4625. You can send us an email. That is web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can go ahead and on Twitter, add us @worldsoccertalk. Send us a message there. Facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. And of course, worldsoccertalk.com. Click on the podcast in the main navigation and then leave your comments in the most recent episode, and we'd love to read those out in a future episode. Kartik, what's going on with Beyond the 90 and the Substack and the developments with Twitter?
Yeah, so I am going to try and use Substack notes as much as possible, although there isn't a critical mass of people on there. It's really kind of just influencers who are now just influencing one another because I like people on Substack notes. But Beyond the 90 is on Substack. We just did a thing on Roberto De Zerbi that I wanted to do earlier in the week, just didn't have the time. But that's a conversation for another day. But read the article, what he's doing at Brighton, what he did at Sassuolo before tactically, I mean, again, not necessarily from a result standpoint, but from a tactical standpoint, so interesting to watch Brighton today. And then at Twitter, I get the sense that there's a real fatigue and anger about Elon Musk and some of the changes he's made. And the blue check thing, I think, is kind of funny. And I should say that I actually pay for Twitter Blue because I need to be able to edit my tweets because I make so many typos. And those of you who follow me on Twitter have seen seen so many tweets over the years with typos that you guys have had to transcribe in your head because I've made mistakes. So Twitter Blue has allowed me the ability to go back and edit those, which is what I'm grateful for. That's why I subscribe. So I still have a blue tick, even though everybody else seems to have lost theirs. But I do think that the blue tick thing is just one factor. Like, there's a lot of people who are angry about him segregating accounts, suggesting things based on an algorithm that are of people you don't follow. It's angering people. In the soccer space, I'm seeing people who don't want the toxicity, as I would put it. Sorry, I know I'm going to offend people. The toxicity of the U.S. men's national team. In social media influencers, and I'm not talking about the media people. I'm not talking about the really good writers who cover the national team, like the Jeff Carlisle and others. I'm talking about the people who have made a Twitter kind of bullying U.S. Fans and have made that their shtick, getting suggestions because of the new algorithm, because you like soccer, you're seeing all of these things about, this MLS player sucks, and this guy who's in a European academy should be starting, and Berhalter should be deported. And all of this sort of nonsense. There's more anger about that. And then I'm seeing anger about people who are MLS fans saying that they're seeing too much from the Premier League, seeing too much of Wrexham. We know they're sensitive about that. So the algorithm has changed, and people are kind of upset about it on all sides of the spectrum in terms of soccer fandom.
Yeah. No, it is interesting to watch. And all these changes, because I mean, soccer Twitter has been a thing for a long time, right? As far as a place to go to get into discussions and leave feedback and talk to a lot of us, to talk about the beautiful game. I mean, there's other places too. I mean, there's websites such as ours. There's Reddit. There's Big Soccer. There's Facebook, etc. Instagram. It's all changing in many ways, so I just find it fascinating to watch and see how these changes do impact our experience, because they certainly do in different ways. All right, Kartik. All right, speaking of Wrexham and many other clubs from around the world, as well as national teams, USMNT, of course, and others, what are you going to do this weekend, and what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.